there, welcome to Blockhead, the podcast where cartoonists talk comics and just about everything else. My name is Jeff Grogan, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so in a series of conversations with comics creators about their lives, their work, and comics. So sit back and enjoy. Hey gang, welcome to a brand new episode of Blockhead, and do we have a doozy for you today? Yes indeed, Dean Haspiel, one of the nicest guys in comics, is here today to talk about his brand new Kickstarter, The Red Hook times Dean Haspiel. That's right, Dean Haspiel invades the fictional world of New Brooklyn and the Red Hook, or is it the other way around? I'm not exactly sure. And this conversation didn't make it any clearer. When fiction and reality overlap, you know, who knows what's real and what's fantasy. It's no longer clear. Anyway, Dean is here and we have a long and interesting conversation. It's the first of a promised two interviews we'll be doing with Dean over the next few weeks or so. This is number one, all about the Kickstarter, and then we're going to talk more broadly in the second part sometime at the end of this month. So look forward to that. But this one's a great one because Dean is a great raconteur, and this was a really enjoyable conversation. I had a great time with Dean and love listening to his thoughts and ideas, where his ideas come from, how they're generated and how he thinks about making comics. It's all here today, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. Before we get into the show, though, stop, check out the show notes, follow the Kickstarter link to Dean Haspiel's The Red Hook times Dean Haspiel, and check out his brand new Kickstarter. Check out the rewards. Look into the project. You're going to find it's something that you're really going to want to support because it is absolutely terrific. If you're not familiar with The Red Hook, it was a Ringo Award-winning webtoon, first of all, webcomic, and it's been collected in a couple of books from Image. I've got in my hand right now The Red Hook Volume 1, called New Brooklyn, which came out, I'm not exactly sure when, 2018 maybe, I'm not sure. But this is just a terrific book, and the concept is wonderful. Brooklyn breaks away, a brokenhearted Brooklyn breaks away from Manhattan, breaks away from the United States, and becomes its own self-governing body, if you will. With its own constitution, its own laws, its own economy, and its own monetary system, which is based in art objects. So you can trade art for purchases and commodities. And the Red Hook itself is a love letter to superheroes and a love letter to Brooklyn. There are a number of references to Brooklyn throughout for those who are in the know. One of the first villains in there is called the Bensonhurst. One of the ostensible heroes in it is the Greenpoint. And so neighborhoods in Brooklyn turn up in really fun ways. And you can tell Dean had a lot of fun with this book, and I'm betting he's had even more fun injecting himself into this fictional universe in The Red Hook times Dean Haspiel. So do yourself a favor, follow that link, head over to Kickstarter and check it out right now before we get into the show. You will not be disappointed. That said, why don't we get right to it, okay? Without further ado, Dean Haspiel and myself in conversation. As always, I'll be waiting for you on the other side. Hey, welcome Dean Haspiel to Blockhead. It's great to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeff.
Yeah. You know, I've been aware of you and your presence on the comic scene for a long, long time. And it's great to finally get a chance to meet you and have a conversation. One of the things I wanted to touch on first was we both have a mutual love, and that's Brooklyn. I lived in Brooklyn for about 15 years, from 1993 to about 2008, for my wife
apart.
And I.
What part?
We lived in Park Slope and then Sunset Park. And
Okay, cool.
yeah, and I had a studio in Gowanus, 94 9th Street for a number of years there. So I got to know it real well. I love
Wait, 94 9th Street, you said? 94 9th
94
Street?
94 9th Street. Yep. 94 9th Street.
So,
Like on Third Avenue.
on Thursday, so I had a studio right there as well.
No. Did you, was
Yeah,
it,
absolutely.
who was the landlord?
I don't remember the landlord. It was a guy that took over, and it was basically on between 9th and 10th Street on 2nd Avenue.
Okay.
Across the street, outside my window, was the Kentile floor sign that then
Okay.
became kind of like a t-shirt that represented Brooklyn for many years. And then they took down the sign eventually, and then I guess that symbol kind of disappeared with it. I don't know. And I moved to Brooklyn about 26 years ago from Manhattan. I'm a native New Yorker from Manhattan, born in New York Hospital, lived in the Upper West Side. And, when Manhattan was getting too expensive to live in, you moved to Brooklyn. For me, Brooklyn was like moving to the country in a way, you know. I always explain it was the first time I heard quiet, and quiet was very loud to me. Like I could be in my bedroom on the third floor of where I've been living on Carroll Street in Carroll Gardens.
Oh yeah.
And I could hear footsteps, outside three floors below. That's late at night. That's how loud it was. And when I first entered that neighborhood in 97, 1997, there was a lot of old school Italians, and they didn't necessarily like people like me coming in. They would cough, but say the word yuppie underneath it. I'm like, yuppie? Jeez, like I wish I had the wallet of a yuppie, like, come on, the bank account. And I actually wrote a lot about the that kind of introduction to the neighborhood in a web comic series I did for DC Comics under their Zuda imprint. It was called Street Code, and Street Code was borrowed from a Jack Kirby autobiographical story he did, his only autobiographical story. It was 10 pages long, right? That he did in 1983 called Street Code. In fact, I just talked about it on another podcast, the Jacked Kirby podcast. It'll be coming out soon. And we do talk about Street Code. So anyway, I borrowed that. And in fact, that was our pitch title for, if you're aware of Harvey Pekar's The Quitter,
Sure, yeah, got it right here.
which is basically his origin story, And we pitched it as Street Code until one day Harvey called up me and the editor, and he was in a panic. And he's like, "I need to change the title of the book." I was like, "What's it gonna be called?" Harvey's like, "I want to call it The Quitter." I was like, "The Quitter? Why?" He's like, "Because everything I tried to do, I quit, and I wanted the whole world to know I was a quitter." I was like, "Okay," I didn't think a book called The Quitter would sell that well in the market, you know. So then I kind of did a Will Eisner type cover to, where I did a lettering treatment where it's anthropomorphic almost, and oh,
Got
you
it
have it
right
in
here.
hand right
Yeah, you
now.
got it right
That's
there.
awesome. And it did pretty well. And obviously he had his own fan base, right? And then the next graphic novel I would do for Vertigo was called The Alcoholic. And I'm like, what the hell am I doing here? I went from the Quitter to the alcoholic, like, what am I? The third one managed to be called Cuba, My Revolution, which was
Yeah,
pretty
I've
heady.
got that one
So,
here too,
oh,
actually.
wild. Oh, without the cover. Okay. Oh,
And I
yeah.
wanted to, yeah, we'll have to cover this. This is, I hate to tell you, it's an eBay purchase,
That's fine. Whatever.
but I
It's
got to
hard to
tell you,
find.
I want to talk to you about this book later on, because
Sure.
this is a phenomenal book.
Oh, we can talk about that. I mean, so for a while there, listen, I grew up wanting, my dream was to draw the Fantastic Four someday, which did happen. Okay. But I also was, then I discovered, American Splendor, Harvey Pekar or Chester Brown's Yummy Fur. And I realized comics could be anything. It wasn't just Marvel and DC superheroes. I was a little too old for the underground movement, Like I went to like that gritty black and white, comics phase for alternative comics, Love and Rockets and that kind of
Yeah,
stuff.
sure.
And then would do my own. So like when I wasn't ready for prime time, I wasn't good enough to draw for Marvel and DC. I started to write and draw my own stories, create my own characters. And then, like I was saying before, at some point, I didn't graduate from college. I actually went to SUNY Purchase about 2 years after I should have gone.
Okay, you're
Wait,
shitting. Yeah,
what's
because
the
I'm a SUNY Purchase grad.
really?
Yeah,
Oh,
1984.
wow.
Yeah. What the hell did I get? I got a BFA. A BFA from in studio art.
In studio art.
Studio art,
Wow.
yeah. You know, painting the whole gang, you know.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. I don't want to steer the conversation
Oh,
away,
please.
but I started off my undergrad at Philadelphia College of Art in the late 70s.
Oh, wow.
Quit school, screwed around for a couple of years, and then I went back to SUNY Purchase because it was the local college for me.
Yep, and it was affordable.
It was
And I don't know how
affordable.
affordable it is now, but yeah, it was affordable back then for
Yep.
sure. And in fact, if you remember the campus, it's very like
Oh,
it
yeah.
was very Teutonic, very brick laden, and it
Yeah.
was designed like right on the heels of, oh God, I can't remember, Kent State, the
Yeah. Yeah.
famous the shootings
Photograph.
that went down
Yeah.
in Kent State.
1970.
So they created it to be like kind of to deal with riots. So they could control riots if there were to be
Everything
riots back in the day.
spread
Yeah.
out. Yeah. Did you,
So,
what year were you there?
oh gosh, that's where things get blurry. So if I graduated in 85 and I should have been going in 86 to college, the next year, and I elected not to, I probably went in 88 to 90, I think.
Okay.
And I went there for 3 years. My first 2 years was in art. And I gotta say, I've always had an allergic reaction to art class and because so many art teachers rejected the concept and the idea of comic books.
Oh,
And it was
yeah.
clear that I was a cartoonist, but they were always trying to steer you away from that to be a real artist, a fine artist,
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so my allergic reaction was to be like, well, fuck off, fuck art, And by the way, we all know that half a lot of art sucks anyway. It's always like up to the eye of the beholder, right? So, and that's what's great about art too. Like
Sure.
you and I could sit in the same room and I could tell you why something is so great. You can tell me why it's so bad,
Sure.
and that creates such interesting conversation,
Absolutely.
But then I transitioned to film because I realized, well, you know what? The tenets of storytelling is, which is what I'm doing with comics, in that visual medium of film, even though film is moving pictures and sound, whereas comics is like static images with a gutter, a literal gutter that you need to make leaps over and through sometimes, in order to tell the story. But I felt like I could learn more about comics through film
Sure.
studies than from fine art.
Yeah.
I sucked at doing sculpture. I couldn't paint to save my life, all kinds of stuff. So I transitioned and I loved it so much, but I could not afford to continue going to SUNY Purchase. So I was there for like a freshman year. I had two freshmen's year there, I also famously, and you wouldn't have been there at the time, fell off the library roof and broke both of my legs and part of my lower back and my right hand. And I
Oh
was in
my
a wheelchair
God.
for months.
Oh my
Yeah.
God. What were you
Yeah.
doing?
I was drinking, having fun. And
Partying. Yeah.
if you remember, the library roof kind of had a 45 degree angle, you could slide down. So that's what we were doing. And it was like, it changed my life. 21 years old in a wheelchair, making enemies, because then suddenly people come out the woodwork. And when you're handicapped, is when they can make fun of you. So I kept this little list on my right on the wall next to my bed of names of people I was going to kill and murder
Oh
when I
my
got
God.
up. Oh, I
If we went down that list now, are those people still with us?
don't even remember the names, honestly. But I do remember feeling very vulnerable because, I'm
Sure.
a little macho, right? And so, like, to have my friends have to lift me up by my back, arms, and legs to put me onto a toilet.
Oh my
You know what I'm
God.
saying? It's just like
Yeah.
very, sobering. Let's put it that
Wow.
way,
Oh my God.
So,
What an
yeah. So, anyway,
experience.
going back to Brooklyn, like I just thought of Brooklyn. I had some friends who had moved to Brooklyn, post college. I was aware of Brooklyn, and then when I first moved to Brooklyn, for real, truly for economic reasons, I had a girlfriend who kicked me out of our Manhattan apartment in the Lower East. No, it was on 14th Street between First and A. And she broke up with me. It was her apartment, her lease. So I had to find a place. And a friend of mine alerted me that there was an apartment available. And so me and another friend moved into basically a one-bedroom apartment. And he too had just gone through a breakup. He was a musician. He is a musician. He rocks around the world. But we were sitting there, licking our wounds, and me learning about the neighborhood and entering a very Italian neighborhood. And it was very Wild West in a lot of ways. And there were a lot of things I learned that were, very racist and territorial and fascinating, to be honest. It was a lot tougher. You see, I thought I knew everything I need to know about New York through Manhattan, and little did I know about New York until I got to Brooklyn, right? And so I was in Carroll Gardens, and then I learned about Red Hook. And I remember like biking over into the night of Red Hook to a bar that had kind of reopened but not officially. It was called Sonny's Bar, and it was right by the waterfront. And you would walk in, and about and it was you, me, and two other people. And I was getting a whiskey on the rocks, and you were getting, I don't know, a beer, and someone else got like a gin and tonic, and someone got a vodka. They would give me a piece of paper, and they would put in four lines. All right. And then if I went back up and I got three more drinks, they would cross off the four into five and then two more, so on and so forth. By the end of the evening, they would times that by like $3 or $4, right? And one reason why they did that system is because they weren't officially open, because it was an old bar that had kind of reopened. But if cops came by, oh, the bar was just hanging out with all their friends,
Okay,
and
didn't have a
like, so there
license.
was no like, and it was just like keeping a tally, as it were. And I remember loving that concept. But yeah, and then I kind of fell in love with Sonny's Bar. And I'm not a person that goes to a bar a lot. Like when I find a bar, that's my bar that I go to occasionally, and so I would wind up there once in a while, and it was hard to get there. And that was the other thing I liked about it. And then once it became popular, official and popular, then like everyone and their mom was showing up. It was like, Beyonce and Jay-Z would show. I mean, they come to my corner often already as is, because there's this pizza place around the corner from me called Lucali's that's kind of very hip and famous right now. So like you'll see all these like Escalades parked on the sidewalks, and like the security are watching movies while famous people are eating a couple slices of pizza and taking over the neighborhood, kind of thing. But yeah, so I would meet people, talk to people. I'm a people person. I like to ask questions. I'm not a journalist proper, but I'm an interested party, stories. I love stories, And so I would try to like, I would write some of these down either on a blog that I was keeping. Sometimes I would convert those stories into comics. When I was younger, I just thought I would draw the stories and other people would write them. I didn't feel confident as a writer. But after a while, I started to realize my understanding of making comics is that image is text too. I am writing stories through drawing,
Absolutely.
so I realized, well, maybe I do have a sense of story making through writing as well, which is why I started to write my own stories, so but I've drawn so many other people's stories, and I think collaborating is really important for any story making artist, because then you're just leaning onto your own ability, or you only draw or perform or shoot the stuff that you feel that you know. And I think what's great about collaboration is to draw stuff that is like, wait, I've never done that before. I've never thought about that,
Different
or
perspective.
arriving at something in a different way. So,
Well, and so you've actually, I mean, one, I subscribe to your Substack, and I really enjoy your writing in the Substack. And you've written some longer pieces in there that I really enjoyed, and your wordplay is excellent. But you're also a playwright.
Oh my God, yeah. So that happened by accident. When I went to transition to film school for that 1 year, I love film. I love cinema. I watch probably a movie a night, or at least a TV show or something, after it's kind of a reward system for me. And I've actually made a couple of short films recently. But like I was going to go from comics to film. That was my kind of like where my dream, in a way. But film is just a lot of work, and talk about collaboration. Like you need a lot of other people. Sure, you can do things with a few people. You can make something on your phone these days with just a couple of people, right? But my understanding for many, many years, where you need a crew, you need craft service, you need food, like. And it's very expensive. And what I loved about comics is that you can do anything with a blank piece of paper. It's an unlimited budget of the blank piece of paper. It's from your mind, your imagination, right? And Maybe a cartoonist or kind of control freaks, you know? So you get to do the whole thing yourself and not have to rely and wait for someone else or wait for a script or whatever.
Sure.
And even recently, when I've done some artwork for a job, I have to remind myself, oh, I have to wait for it to be lettered or colored or whatever. And will I even like it? Will it be the way I would have done it or something? Or they take and they elevate it in a way that is much more profound, you know? It really depends. So you're always running the gamut on that. So yeah, I think when it came to writing, and then I found a sweet spot where someone was like, I was talking to someone at a playwright at a wedding dinner, and they were saying how there was a festival coming up at the Brick in Williamsburg, and the idea was to have like a few week run of like plays and comics or comics inspired plays or people who work in comics doing play, whatever it was. It was always
Yeah,
about the
sounds
two,
great.
right? The hybrid. And she advised me, Crystal Skillman is her name. She's a playwright. And her husband is Fred Van Lente, who writes comics, and he also
Oh
writes plays.
yeah, I know
And
him.
she encouraged me. I was like, well, I have some screenplays I wrote, but honestly, when I thought about them, because they were kind of Tarantino inspired, you know, like Tarantino basically writes plays, you know, when it comes down to it. There's a lot of wordplay, you know. And so I'd written the, and I realized I could take this one idea, cut it in half, because it was kind of like two stories, and then just lean on one story, and I submitted it, and it got taken. And I remember, like, oh my God, there's this like director, writer, producer who wanted to take on the play, and they did four performances of it during this festival, and suddenly I'm a playwright, you know, by accident, you know.
Great.
And then I did three more, you know, from not
Yeah.
for festivals, but just other, you know, working with people who believed in me that want to produce. Ian W. Hill did my first two plays, and then my friend from college, actually, Phil Cruz, who's a director, and also hold on a second. Hello. Hi, I'm doing an interview right now, but we'll talk soon, okay? Yeah, I'm at my studio, by the way, in Red Hook, in case you're wondering. I'll be getting some
I think I
nonsense.
got that impression. Yeah.
Yeah. But then the other two are by produced by Phil Cruz, who also starred in them, with another buddy of ours, Seth Gilliam of The Walking Dead and The Wire and Oz and a whole bunch of TVs and movies and stuff like that. And then Stoya, international porn star, was also in two of my plays, which was a lot of fun. But so anyway, but theater is interesting because it evaporates. Like you don't. Like, if even you try to shoot a play, I don't mean as a movie, but just point a camera at a production, it's off. You get nothing what it's like to sit in the audience, you know, and experience this together, you know. And so, on the one hand, there's a magic to that that's undeniable, but then, like, it goes away, like it never happened, you know, and then you just have a poster of it, and you're like, oh my God. So, that's one of the other reasons why I love film. Is because at least I can show it to you, you know, like you got a link or you go to a theater, whatever it is, you know, or on your TV set. We can project these things anywhere now, you know. But again, it comes with the high cost of making a low budget thing, you know. So I always return back to comics, but I've just finished writing a new play. I've started writing another one. It could be a movie, it could be a graphic novel. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. I try to employ the virtues of each medium. So if it's going to be a comic book, how is it a comic? If it's going to be a play, how is it a play? Movie, the same question, you know? So I do think about that and try to honor those things because
Sure.
of
How do
that.
you utilize the medium in
Exactly.
telling the story? You're using the strengths of whatever medium you're working with.
That's right.
So, what kinds of subjects are your plays dealing with? Are the same kind of things that your comics deal with? I mean, your comics are, depending on what you're doing, it's a wide array of genre.
I think in my comics, I for some reason lean more into a romance. Ultimately, it's always a
You
romance,
do. Yeah,
you
it's
know.
true.
I do love love, and I do love conflict. Like I realize after a while that I'm attracted to conflict, and that might have something to do with the way I was brought up, you know, the love from my parents in some way. And then I think I was always seeking that. And that's what I do, like in my second Kickstarter, Billy Dogman Jane Legit, which is a collection of like love stories, but they're always bickering and fighting, and then yet they're like these love titans that kind of affect their town, you know? Just when they have a lover's spat, it can like change the whole tone. And I also get that from the fact that there are quiet people in the world, and then there are people who walk into a room and take over a room just by entering it, right? And so like that was my parents, and that was kind of like where I came from, and kind of the energy maybe I give off sometimes is that I can impact a room just by walking into it. Now it sounds like an ego trip, you know, but I've seen it happen, and I also know like I see other people do it when they walk into a room, so I recognize it, you know, and sometimes you either like prepared for it and want it, and there are other times you're like, not tonight, I just can't, I can't do this. Hit this person, you know,
Sure.
but that's where I infused Billy Dogman Jane Legit with that prowess, you know, but yeah, man, and so with my plays, the first one was called Switch to Kill, and it was kind of like a crime noir about two brothers, but only one of them knows that they're brothers because the other one thinks that the brother is dead, and
Okay.
that's part of the mystery. And I kind of had a lot of fun with abstract wordplay and like, what is a crime story and that kind of stuff. Second one's called Harry Carey Kane, or AKA Die Again. And it's about a boxer who died a year ago and has amnesia and slowly but surely finds out who he is, and he's become an angel of death against his will. And so
Okay.
there's kind of a love story there because he starts to realize every time I'm around someone, and this happened to me. There was a few months where every time I went out the door in the street, I used to live in Soho at one point, someone would die, jump off a building, get hit by a car. I was like, and I started to think, is that, am I an angel of death?
Oh,
Like,
wow.
what's going on here, right? So
Yeah.
I kind of turned that into a play or a story idea. And then he starts to realize, well, if I'm like relieving people of their mortal coil to go to heaven or hell or whatever it is, who was supposed to come from me? And why didn't they come from me? So that's part of the story, you know? And then the third one was called The Last Bar at the End of the World, that was semi-inspired by Sonny's Bar, and also a kind of a story about a cartoonist and legacy and dealing with the pain of a breakup and the obsession that we sometimes lean into when we break up with someone or someone breaks up with us. And then recently was The War of Wu, which is sounds like another love story, which is about a demon who recruits four New Yorkers to broker a treaty between Satan and God to help alter the afterlife. And it's kind of a black comedy, you know?
Okay.
And then recently I just wrote one that that actually was I tried to write in 2018 and couldn't. I didn't like what I was doing, and I scrapped half of it, and then I completely rewrote it. And it has something to do with I was trying to think of a new kind of horror, but it's really not a horror story. But the horror was started with, what if you came home? Are you married? Do you have anybody
Yep.
listening? Okay.
Long time married, no kids.
All right. So you come home with your wife or partner or
Yeah, my
okay,
wife.
or wife, and you know, you're just kind of hanging out in the room. And then you're talking to each other about whatever the hell you were talking about as you walked in the door. But then you notice that there's this guy, this giant person sitting on your coffee table. And you're like, okay, like what's going on here? Like, and they didn't break in. You open the lock on your doors and everything, and there's no broken windows or anything. And you start asking the person, what do you want? Who are you? And they don't say anything. They don't move. They don't talk. They're just breathing. And then after a while, because you can't communicate with it, you start to bicker with your wife about something. Like it kind of engages something. And you start to realize that it's not the problem isn't the person there. It's whatever you guys aren't been talking about. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff there. And the title is The Man in the Middle of the Room, which can be a metaphor
Sure.
for what you don't talk about in your relationships.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Desires. So the horror is not the monster that's sitting there. It's you. It's
Right.
us, you know, thing.
The
Which is another
unspoken.
thing I've been thinking about with AI, is that AI is not the problem. It's the people who use AI. We feed AI all day long by just putting up digital things for free, and somehow it scrapes the internet and takes it all, whatever it wants, you know,
Sure,
basically,
yeah.
until there are laws employed saying you can't do that, right?
Right.
So, but the real problem is the laziness of let's say, a corporation, or, you know, that decides, well, you know, we used to hire people to kind of help us think about our ideas, but now I can just plug in some words and here's
Yeah.
a mood board, you know, or a movie
Or a comic
nowadays.
book.
Or a comic book, and that happened to me recently, you
Right. I
know.
just I read that Substack story.
So thank you. And then, but really, okay, I get that. I get them saving on costs, and just don't tell me about it. And then suddenly you realize there's no work in that way. Not that I did that kind of work a lot myself, but I understand a lot of people did. But really, it's the other artists, and I have friends sending me like, oh, you should really use this or use that for this. And I'm like, for what? I like the blue pencil on the crappy paper, and then the brush ink or the Micron pen line that I'm putting on top of my work. Yeah, I'm scanning it in and I'm digitally coloring it or gray toning it and then lettering it that way. I don't need to, but I'm electing to. I don't think that's AI. I just think it's another assistant, a tool, a digital tool, you
Sure.
know. But then I put stuff out there like web comics, and yeah, it's a free-for-all buffet, you know.
Yeah.
For AI to do what they want and then amalgamate it and turn it into whatever the AI look is these days, which is very slick and shiny, you
Yeah.
know, sometimes truly creepy.
Yeah.
It's the fun stuff, right? Is
Yeah,
when it goes bananas. But to employ it for real is where I'm like, well, okay, humanity, we're done, right? We're just
right.
going bot style. Like, all right, you didn't want the human hand to touch it. You wanted the thought that, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I vacillate between trying to say that, you know, people who are working corporate structures may not have the wherewithal, let's say, to understand a nuance, but maybe they do. Maybe that's their way of doing art. You know, I can't begrudge them. You know, it's not like I'm saying, oh, you got to get the real artist to do it. No, it my. Any, you know, the guy down the hall that never could draw, you know, or never really can type into something, maybe that is an art form, you know, and I can't begrudge that.
Don't know what to say about AI, but you know, at my age, I'm kind of like, screw it, I'm never going to use it. And I don't know, you know, it's coming. There's no stopping it. Fine. But I don't know how much a part of that world, you know, at my age that I even have to consider, concern myself with, you know?
Right, as we age out, it doesn't even matter. But I do think, yeah, it's not in our hands. We're not gonna stop it. It's
Right.
already here.
Right.
But I do think it becomes an aesthetic quality then, kind of like,
Yeah.
I don't know. I have a friend that whenever we go out to dinner, and we're trying to find a place to eat, they will not look at anything under 4 stars on Yelp. Where meanwhile, I eat like at 1-star restaurants all the time, or I just get cheap Chinese food, right? But they insist for their quality of life, which also means that they better be paying because I can't afford that, right? But it is funny to me, and in a way, that's the same kind of, I think, concept, which is, oh, well, there will be people who employ AI and use AI, and then there are people who don't care if it was made by AI. They just
Yeah,
want the
sure.
thing, you
Yep.
know?
As long as they
It's
have the
kind of like,
product in their hand, they don't really care.
exactly.
I teach young people. I mean, that's my job. And I wonder, as we're teaching them the aesthetics and the formal attributes of art making and things, as we're discussing it, you know, the world they're going into, how is AI going to impact them as
Right.
they're coming up and entering the world? What are they going to be doing with it? How are they going to navigate it? And you know, how do they make use of it, but also how do they maintain their individuality, their personal voice in the midst of all.
Well, I don't know. I mean, listen, I feel like when I was intimidated by the cartoonists growing up that I admired, even when they went abstract, kind of like Picasso style, like Jack Kirby went into like a bizarre Picasso style, like let's just call it that, right? Like bombastic, amazing, his own signature work. But he had the bones of knowing how to draw before that, so he
Sure.
could go there, right? Same thing with Picasso. And then a generation like me shows up, you know, where I'm an assistant to Howard Chaykin, Walt Simonson, Bill Sienkiewicz. Those guys know how to draw, okay? and then they purposely skew their art into the style that they draw, right? Which is amazing. But they did know how to draw. And so I might have been the generation where they were still teaching anatomy and perspective. Nowadays, do they even do that? Do you teach anatomy and perspective?
Well, that's not part of what I do.
Or do you just start with your style, whatever that's
No,
supposed to be?
it's more complicated than that because you've got a 4-year trajectory and you've got teachers who teach in foundation. I teach in upper level courses, but I always come back to basics, always. In an illustration course, it's always about, look, you got to nail down this anatomy. Even
Right.
if you're stylizing, you got to understand how a bicep works, how an elbow works. You got to know what an arm does. Even if you're stylizing, exaggerating, if you're drawing like George Gross or you're drawing like Picasso or
Right.
whatever you're doing,
Right.
you have to go back to the, you have to have a good foundation. Otherwise, your stuff's not convincing. And this is one of the words we use all the time. Convincing. Is that
That's a
convincing? Is
great
it not
word.
convincing? Because an artist who believes in their style and they put it down and they know what they're doing, they're going to convince you and you enter their world, like Kirby, like Simonson, like Chaykin, like a bunch of others from the history of comics, all coming from different places. George Harriman, it's convincing, right? But if it's not convincing, everything falls apart and you walk away from it. And,
And you're also talking about like a continuity, like in other words, you said George Harriman, Ignatz, right? Like the characters also look like the props, also look like the landscape. Like I started to realize that like I was drawing a certain kind of figure, but when I would use reference to draw the coffee pot or the microwave, and I was being a little more slave to the reference, it didn't live in the world that I was creating, right?
Absolutely. Yep, I get
So
exactly.
like even if it looks wrong, it should live in that world, right? Like, so that's probably a microwave. Okay, I get it. I see what it is. But if I'm trying to draw accurately because I'm using reference and relying on it, and I to this day, I still have to remind myself, oh no, Dean, look at it from afar. Like, don't look at it up close because unless there's a very specific reason, because because story clarity for story clarity purposes, put it into your library, as it were, of your. And then I learned something really interesting. Two things. One is what a masterpiece is and what style is. Now, a masterpiece is when you are an assistant and you're working with the quote master as it were, and helping their vision and keeping within the convincing library of their style, right? The masterpiece that breaks you off is when you finally arrive at your own thing. And you are able to show the piece of work that says it's my, I am now walking, I'm removing myself from this, what do you call it? This gig or this relationship, and I'm going to start my own thing,
Right,
so
you got
that's a
your own vision.
masterpiece. And so we always use the word masterpiece of like, oh, he made a masterpiece. No, the masterpiece is the thing that allowed you to become your own artist in a way, and then style. And style is something about how when you finally give up and can't draw or no longer copy and ape the art that influenced you, because you finally found your own kind of signature style, your own, again, your library of work is when you've arrived at your own style, as it were. And I can never figure out, like I know what Kirby's art, Ditko, I can spot Alex Toth, like so many different artists from afar, right? John Buscema. I can even discern John Buscema from Sal Buscema,
Sure, me too.
right?
Yeah, me
Or,
too.
it's harder for Keith Giffen because he was always keeping other artists, and that was really cool. Trevor Von Eden, whatever. Michael Golden. But, like, I can't figure out what my style looks like. I feel like I'm still a little derivative of my influences,
You got your own thing going on. I can see kind of what you I can see what you like. I'm looking at, okay, this book,
Oh, the
which I
Red Hood.
love this book, by the way.
Thank you.
Which the first volume of Red Hook, which is a lot of fun, folks,
Thank you.
if you're
Thank you.
listening to this. And I could tell you had a blast doing this. You
Oh
had
my
a
God.
blast.
Yeah.
So, but when I'm looking at this, there's Alex Toth, there's Kirby in there,
Yeah.
there's Darwin Cook in there.
Oh yeah.
You got some of that going on, but there's a lot of Dean Haspiel in there too, and a lot of classical superhero cartoon references in here, which is actually quite different from Cuba, which is a different thing. But you bring it all together and do something with it, and there's something with it that makes it uniquely your own. And what that is exactly in terms of anatomical references, layout, storytelling capabilities, it's just yours. There's a certain rhythm to your storytelling that's uniquely yours.
That's ultimately what I think about is what I think is mine. I can show you on a podcast what I mean, but like I think it's actually the writing coming through is what is my distinction is the layouts and the way I write is stronger than what I'm drawing. If that makes sense, you know, like so these are thumbnail layouts, right?
Oh,
This is all
cool.
about. Once I do this,
Love
once I
it.
figure this stuff out, the comic is done. Now it's all execution and craft. This part is the hardest part of making comics, is I've written a script, or actually, to be more pure, would be just to start laying out, right? Like just think in terms of images and arrive at story that way, you know? I tend to write a script because I'm still trying to be a screenwriter. I'm still trying to make movies, you know?
Well, a couple of things. Well, before I jump onto this other question, it's one of the things that actually is I've developed as a in my own comics. I've spent more and more time writing and writing and writing and rewriting, and then taking the text of what I've written, and I'm working digitally primarily now, so I work in Procreate and I pop it into a page, and that's when I start to figure out how I'm going to visualize, and I visualize in layer upon layer. So you start off with thumbnails and lay it out, but it's always beginning lately, more so than ever before, with text. And I really come to that realization that the text, even if the text is only alluding to what you're going to see, the text is where it starts. Now, before I forget, I want to talk to you how you used visuals and text in Billy Dogma and Jane Legit, your last Kickstarter, because I honestly found that really unique. I don't know, you were using the visuals, the way you were doing the visuals, like there was great poetry to that book. I absolutely love that book. And I found it really very captivating and very poetic. And not only poetic in the text, but the images were working in a way that I don't see a lot of comics artists working, in that they were metaphoric. They were not like, and I don't have the copy with me here to show you, but they were not like always literal interpretations of exactly what was going on. They were allusions to what the characters were feeling and what they were going through, rather than, and I thought that was fascinating. And I'm not sure anybody else, was picking up on that, or people who would talk about it, but I was fascinated by it because I don't see a lot of people thinking that way
Well,
and
thank you.
making comics that way.
Well, I'll tell you the dirty secret is, and I definitely, and thank you for recognizing that and seeing that. And again, how do I explain? A couple ways. So, like, you only recognize bad lettering when it's bad, but you never notice good lettering because it's just working, right? Same thing with like writing and drawing, the whole hybrid of it all. If it comes off slick and simple, that's the magic trick, right? So like a long time ago, I was trying to explain to somebody like, what you don't do in comics is you don't draw a guy walking through a door and the caption says a man walks through a door. You just got redundant, right? So what the beauty of comics is that I can show you one thing but tell you another. Through script or through thought or something else that's happening. And so I think sometimes I try to employ that depending on the story. And like just like I was saying, how sometimes something just comes off like a play, like a movie, or can if you really break it down, it could have been a play, right? But why is it not a play? It's because they did some cinematic stuff. They did some stuff. So whenever I would draw a Harvey Pekar story, for instance, he would have been just as happy of me drawing his head talking than me reading the words and figuring out when can I go to a hand gesture? When do I go to an establishing shot? When do I draw something that he's talking about that I can then elaborate on visually? He never asked for any of that because he's always a stick figure or a chair, or he drew a car once or
I can
something,
see that.
That's it. So I've always said that the success of a Harvey Pekar story is either that, obviously it could have just been an essay of him talking or having a conversation. But it truly was a jazz style because he loved jazz, because he was riffing off with the artist. And I felt like the stronger American Splendor stories were the one where the artist did more, quote, writing with the art, if that makes
Yes.
sense.
Yes. Absolutely.
So maybe to answer your question, as I'm depending on what you're talking about, because it's the Billy Dogma comic has a bunch of vignettes,
Yeah.
it's short stories. I was probably trying to figure out, the metaphor, because it's corny as hell, that comic, but it's so heartfelt that you can't deny it if you let it,
Well, I love that whole idea that two of them, there's this relationship that's kind of fated to be. And the two of them realize that it's incredibly destructive, but the pull of it is so compelling that they can't pull. But and that's really the essence of all, that's Romeo and Juliet. It's all these great love stories. And as I was reading that, I said Dean Haspiel is a romance artist. He's a
Oh,
romance.
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which was a
Thank you.
surprise to me. I didn't really think of you that way.
Well, even in COVID Cop, which I want to thank you again, because I've done it in an email or whatever, but thank you for loving COVID Cop,
Yeah, I loved
because
it. Yeah.
another big swing, and it's a short story, but ultimately it's a love story. Like I'm taking the piss out of the pandemic. I'm playing with ideas because we're all struggling. And I actually did a Red Hook story about first responders, during that time, like a 4-page story. But going back to COVID Cop, like I really was trying to do like some kind of like Mad Max meets Toxic Avenger meets Judge Dredd in a world where there's only 2% of humanity is left, and it's just and it's kind of like a 2000 AD, like a comic book, like some dystopian thing. But then at the heart of it is this little love story. And I've already written the second issue. I'm publishing them as one shots, right? So that they can feel standalone, but clearly they're the progression, right? And I have three in mind. I've already plotted out the third one. So I think my next Kickstarter will be COVID Cop 2,
Oh,
which
great.
will be a title. In other words, the first one's COVID Cop, the second will be COVID Cop with another word, and the third won't be like that. So they feel like you can just get that if you needed it, because that's how I write. It comics is an art of reduction and economy, right? So I try to pack as much as I can into, and even with the new Red Hook one, there's a lot of story that happens in 24 pages,
Yeah, I can't wait to see that. And that's actually the reason, I mean, one of the reasons we got together today was actually because your new Kickstarter, which if people don't know about, they really got to go to Kickstarter and look up Dean Haspiel, the Red Hook Times, Dean Haspiel.
Yeah, the Red Hook Times, the inhabit and the time, the X is something that I lifted from Basquiat ex Warhol, or Warhol ex Basquiat, that famous like boxing poster when they were going to be like
Oh yeah, sure, I remember
versus
that.
or whatever. And then recently there was Godzilla ex King Kong. So I don't know if it's a versus, if it's a times, if it's a with, or it just creates an interesting idea of some kind of frisson, like what is it, and the risk is like it's the Red Hook, which is a character probably most people don't know about, times or whatever, me, the author, like how narcissistic can you get, but I feel like I do tell a really good story if you're willing to pick it up.
Oh,
And
yeah.
what's cool about the Kickstarter too, which will be going till about March 28th, is there's some really good rewards. It's affordable. But also, if you didn't pick up COVID Cop and Billy Dogma, there is a tier for that,
Yes, right. And
that
I
you have some
think.
copies left. And I will be selling them at shows this year, the few shows that I do.
But I
So.
do encourage people to listeners to check out not only the Kickstarter, but also check out the rewards and COVID Cop and Billy Dogma and Jane Legit. Fantastic stuff, Dean, that you produced in the last year or so.
Well, thank
And
you.
it's really great to see you on Kickstarter and building an ongoing community of support, because it's a great place for independent cartoonists, and it's really great to kind of see you break free in a lot of ways. And not that you haven't been free before. I mean, you've done, obviously your career is filled with some really great high watermarks.
Well, thank you.
But
Thank you.
this is great, man. It's a lot of fun. It's great to see. And the Red Hook, I think, is probably something that's particularly personally important to you. At least that's what I
It's my
got.
love letter. It's my love letter to superhero comics,
Yeah, to superhero comics and to Jack Kirby and and all those guys, and to
Well,
bring
let me tell
to
you real quick what
yeah.
the new comic is I'm veering into a different realm. So speaking of Harvey Pekar, or doing autobio versus superhero. So like one of the ideas I had was, Peter Parker gets bit by a radioactive spider and becomes Spider-Man, right? What if Spider-Man became Peter Parker? Right? And I started thinking about like, what if I took my superhero comic, this Red Hook series that I did, the saga that I did for about 5 seasons at Webtoon that I hope to put out as an omnibus. And then I was like, well, he works at basically Sonny's bar. That's his day job, right? Or night or whatever, when he's not being called to be a hero, In fact, part of the story is like, is the mask wearing him or is he wearing the mask? And superheroes aren't what they used to be, kind of thing, right? And so he's at a bar. But like there'll be a little bit of something that's like a surreal, and there's actually a weird surreal love story that happens in this Red Hook comic
Oh,
that he
great.
has there.
Of
But
course.
I mean, I have to, I can't help
Right, of
myself.
course.
And yet there is conflict, but what happens when it starts to slowly become just a story about people at a bar, in Brooklyn,
Oh, cool. I like that.
Is that good enough? And then, oh wait, lo and behold, Dean Haspiel inserts himself into his own creation. And then what happens in that, and this is weird, it's why I'm calling it a meta mem noir. It becomes it's semi a speculative memoir where, and people do it all the time, where you insert yourself into a story and then you write how you think you would behave in a situation. Okay. So that's the speculative part, right? But then I also insert into this story something that actually happened to me. And yes, I'm conveying it in comic book terms, right? But I'm telling a story that where I think this is how I would act, and then I tell a story of how I actually act. And then there's a
Oh,
thematic
interesting.
quality to this as well. So that's part of this little epic 24-page story. And I'm trying to veer the Red Hook into that space, And I've already kind of plotted out a story that I want to do more after that if I get to it. But like I said, I'm trying to like build out like this little Dean Haspiel universe via crowdfunding because it didn't really make sense to go to a publisher unless a publisher wanted to give me all the rights and pay me a lot of money in advance to make this stuff. And that ain't happening anymore, unless I try to sell it as a TV show and maybe these comic books will turn this into a
It
TV show.
could. You
I
never
don't know.
know. Well, I love the, I don't know if you call it the meta aspect of it, but it's really interesting. And the idea of playing off the idea of fiction versus reality versus fiction, I think it's great. And it sounds like a lot of fun. I can't believe you can cram it all into 24 pages.
Oh, you'll see. You'll see. I
That's
did
called
it.
economic storytelling, that's for sure.
That's right. But also with breathing room, because the trick is to, I always say, like, you have to earn a pause. And if you can give me enough, to then I can then you can give me these moments, and actually Mike Mignola does a great job
Oh, yeah.
of drawing ambience on a
Yeah,
page.
I love
There's
that.
narrative, right? But somehow he always sneaks in here and here, like a statue kind of looking, or a skull, or something that ominous happening, right? That isn't in the narrative of the dialogue or the conversation, but it's happening around them,
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
giving that
Mignola.
sense of yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
I love Mignola, and I love his pacing. And it is very filmic. You know, it's
Yes,
very,
absolutely.
it's very, and I'm trying to think of directors that remind me of maybe Ingmar Bergman, but I
Oh,
mean,
sure.
you know, there's definitely a pacing in Mignola's storytelling style, which is so evocative and so.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you make comics?
I may come. I'll send you a couple if you want, if you give me your address.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I've been independent forever. And I started off like you, comics guy, went to school, decided to start into film school, and started, this was in Philadelphia College of Art. I started studying film and animation. And I quit school because I was a young kid and I got screwed up. And I took 2 years off. I went back. After discussions with a buddy of mine, I realized that I could, if I couldn't make films on my own, I could make paintings on my own or something like that. So I went back for painting and eventually went on and got my graduate degree in painting, but I always loved comics, and I was always interested in making comics. And but I'd fallen out of it for a long time. But
Mean
finally,
making it or reading it or both?
actually, kind of both. I was always between both comic books and comic strips, and I loved like Calvin and Hobbes. I loved Doonesbury. I loved Peanuts. Those things were huge influences on me, and I was always doing that. And I even worked for a little while as a political cartoonist for a small newspaper. I did that for a while, but I was making all this stuff. And what happened was, I don't know. I graduated from grad school. I think I was really depressed about something, and I was in sort of that in between place, where you don't know what to do when you just get out of school and you haven't found the job you want and all that kind of stuff. So my wife. For my birthday, we were living in Brooklyn, and she had stopped by this. She was working across the street from a comic shop, and she knew I loved comics, and she bought a stack of comics for me, all independent stuff from this comic shop, all black and white comics. And this is in the early 90s. And she brings them home. So, like, Bone was there, and Love and Rockets, and a whole pile of stuff. And man, I was just like, this is incredible. This is unbelievable. I can't believe they're doing this. This is freaking art. This is so great. And I was like, oh, I got to start doing this again. So I started drawing again, and I did some self-publishing in the 90s. I got it through Diamond, and I got it to some stores. And then I got involved in utilizing my comics imagery in big collages, and I did a lot of big collages in newspaper. And I worked like that for a long time in Gowanus. That's where I was. I had a huge studio. It was 800 square feet. And
Wow.
I was making these huge, huge collages in newspaper, and I was exhibiting them in Brooklyn. I was part of a show at the Drawing Center in Manhattan. I did a bunch of stuff, and then I got into this thing where, like, maybe I can make comics out of the collages and make art comics. And so I started doing that, and I got a Zurich grant, and
Oh, awesome.
I published a couple of things that were collage comics, and then I was like. But I want to tell a straight comic story. And then that led one place and led to another. I published with a guy named Kevin Much, an alternative comics newspaper called Pood. And we had
Oh, I
Harley
remember
Quinn.
that. I remember
Yeah.
that. I remember that guy. Yeah.
Okay. So Kevin and I did that together. We were at Mocha a couple of times and sold that around. And I did collage comics in that. And I also, what was great about that was just being able to publish all these great people, in that. And so and after that, man, it's just been like a long circuitous road of kind of going my own path. And
Well, we sound very similar in a lot of ways, except you don't have like Marvel and DC like
I don't.
in your feathered cap or
And
whatever, like.
it's not that I wouldn't have wanted to. It's like the times that I was interested, I think, in applying for that, I wasn't good enough. I wasn't up to my anatomy or my storytelling or whatever it was,
Right.
wasn't happening or wasn't quite there. And I would have loved to have done what you did, like worked for Simonson or Chaikin. That must have been
Right.
awesome for you. And
It was incredible, like because again at that time in 85, our teachers were rejecting the concept of anybody wanting to be a cartoonist. Like, why would you want to do that? In fact, that's in a way the origin of comics, isn't it? Like, wasn't it a bunch of Jews who couldn't get like quote real work, so they had to create a format,
Yeah,
basically,
that's essentially what they did. Yeah,
I
created
mean,
their
so
own world, their own viable medium.
exactly. And so, and I've always felt like my anatomy's not up to snuff. My perspective definitely, I mean, whatever, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, I realize who cares? If
Right.
you care about that, you're not enjoying comics. I'll put it that way. All right. So like, just put out your ideas, and I'll be writing an idea that I'm like, how am I supposed to draw this? Whatever, I'll figure it out. And just as long as you can convey it, the
Oh,
idea of
yeah.
conveying it. You were saying, what was the word you used? Convincing, right?
Yeah.
Convey it and maybe it'll be convincing, as long as it has heart. I think we can draw the heart on the page. You
Oh,
can that can come through,
absolutely. And I think if you believe in what you're doing and you bring that to the page, and also when you have faith in yourself and what you're putting down on the page, that kind of conviction that goes with it comes across. And I agree with that. In the end, it really comes down to what you're trying to say. And like you said, if you have heart in it and passion behind it, it's going to convince people.
So I've drawn other people's stories, right? But whenever
Yeah.
I've written my own stories, I draw, I've started to see a trend. Like I'm writing and drawing the same stories, basically. Do you find that in your own work?
To a certain extent, yeah. But I've yeah and no, but I've kind of been all over the place, and I think that's
Okay.
one of my issues in finding an audience. I've done these sci-fi stories that, like, last year I was doing a sci-fi thing that had both an EC type thing
Oh,
and
cool.
an Archie Comics type thing in the same comic, and it's like, matter and antimatter. But so yeah, I gotta think about that. I don't know. Am I always telling the same story? I gotta kind of look and see what if that's true or not. I know that when I look at what you're doing and what you're saying about romance, I see that coming through, love stories, and that really
And
does build
again,
a relationship.
well, thank you. And it's funny because I think some people might be like, "Well, what kind of romance story is that, Dean?" And it really does come down to like, I always cite this scene because it was so impactful from On the Waterfront, when Brando is trying to bust down that door, and he eventually, it's a violent act, it's horrible. Like, is he coming there to rape? And then she's like. And I hate to say it, but at first she's like, no, like, fuck you, man. Like, don't get off of me. And then, like, she succumbs because she too loves him and they love each other, but they come from this world of strife. And talk about Romeo and Juliet, like, and I feel like that's what I've been writing and drawing all these years is that scene
That
somehow.
tension, right?
That
Between,
tension.
those two people who are fighting against something until they can't fight against it anymore.
That's right. That's right.
And I think that is true. That was the subject of certainly Billy Dogma and Jane Legit, the deep cut piece from last year. Yeah, and that's a great subject. Because at the heart of every great love story, there really is that tension,
Oh, that and to me, it's never about like a secret. Although, secrets are fun, but at the end of the day, after all these years, like what could the secret be? Like ultimately, you've seen all the secrets. So which one is it? You know what I'm saying? Versus a real true, like, oh my God, I didn't see that coming. Like you're just waiting for is it no A, B, or C, right? Like kind of a thing.
Which, yeah.
So that's not as interesting to me. I mean, I still will watch a murder mystery and try to hopefully within play the game of trying to figure out the first 5 minutes.
Oh man, it's like I've watched pretty much every Agatha Christie movie adaptation there is, right? It's always the same, man. It's always the same story, but it's okay. They're captivating stories. There's something magic about her characters or the way she could, something about it, even
You
though
see
you
the risks,
know.
even though or like what's the joke about? What was the TV show with the older lady in the town? The
Oh,
murder,
Jessica. Oh God, now I'm getting it's just.
from the 80s or
Yeah, I know
whatever.
who you're talking about, and it's like escaping my mind. I said it the other night to my wife because we were talking
Well,
about the show.
and the joke is like, God, there must have been a lot of murderers and
Murder,
killers at
She
that.
Wrote.
Murder, She Wrote.
Murder, She Wrote.
A lot of bad people in that small
I
town.
know, who's living in this town?
What kind
Why
of
would you
town is
stay
that?
there?
Yeah.
And what's wrong with this person? Every time they walk out the door, as you were saying before, there's a murder. It's like they're
There's a
accountable.
murder.
It's like one of the shows we watch on BritBox is Father Brown, and Father Brown is surrounded by murder everywhere he goes. It's like, what kind of priest is this? Everywhere he goes, there's death.
If you're watching Columbo, you're waiting for him to walk toward the door and turn around and go, you know what? Let me just ask you one more question. One more thing, like actually, you've seen the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, right?
Oh, do you mean the original version? Sure. Long
Walter
time
Matthau.
ago. Yeah, Walter Matthau. Yeah,
The
Robert Shaw.
best ending. I'll spoil it right here. So if anybody hasn't seen the movie, don't listen to this. But if you remember, they're looking for, I forget which one survives, but he's gotten away, and they know that he has a cold. The guy has a cold or something like that. And they go and they're knocking on doors because they're closing in on the
Remember
suspects.
this now.
And at the very end, they like the, he gets away. He's put his money in the oven. He plays it off like the bad guy, like, okay. And as Walter Matthau's walking out the door, he like sneezes.
Sneezes, yeah.
And Walter Matthau kind of looks and there's a close of his eye, like kind of a wink, like at the end. You
Yep.
don't need to see him get
Oh man,
busted.
you
You know
don't.
he's
That's
getting
great.
busted.
That is a
And it's
great
such a
ending.
funny ending.
Oh my God, it is a great ending. I had forgotten about that till you mentioned it, and I was like, oh my God, I remember now.
Well, it's a great New York movie too.
Yeah,
It's like
sure.
great New York movie.
It
The
is.
only thing that's weird and doesn't like, well, I guess it fits in some way if you allow for character flaw, which was the thing that Marvel Comics introduced to comics, was the flawed hero, right? In the
Yeah.
real space. But he there's this part in the movie where he's just very racist towards Chinese people. Like, there's these Chinese guys he's giving a tour to, and he starts making fun of them, and they kind of make fun. But I was just like, that didn't seem necessary, but at the same time, it shows like otherwise he's just like a knight in shining armor, with a
Yeah.
Walter Matthau face,
Right,
like
right, right.
otherwise he's just like a guy who's really smart and figuring stuff out. So it allows him to be kind of a jerk, or kind of
Yeah.
like humanizes him as being, oh, you got some faults too,
Yeah.
kind of.
Yeah.
Which
And
I
there are
think is
those people.
important to character,
Sure. Well, exactly. If you're gonna draw a character, you don't want to draw an iconic, unless you're doing something that is iconic. When you're trying to
Right.
deal with real people are flawed and come in all, they're complicated. They come in all kinds of shape. And that's not to excuse, those kind of attitudes. It's simply to say they exist, and those people make up stories, and stuff like that. But no, it's so great. It seems like we have a lot of overlap.
Oh yeah, man.
A lot of
Oh yeah.
overlap.
You got to
So,
get me out there to Adelphi or
oh yeah,
Adelphi.
well, we're gonna do that. I've talked
Okay.
to my colleagues about it, and we're gonna have you out here to do, if you're up for it, to do an artist lecture. We have these things where we're having one next week. We had one last week. And you do a little presentation on a stage in front of the students, and then you come around, or before that, actually, you meet some of our senior students and give them a chat, do a little crit with them. And
Yeah, that'd be
it's a
great.
great afternoon. It really is a great day, and
Yeah,
it's a
yeah.
lot of fun. So yeah, we definitely want to have you out here because I've talked you up, and especially, because what's interesting to me as a comics artist, you're not only you're so interested in a wide array, right,
Oh,
of
yeah.
art forms, and in fact, the Red Hook Volume 1 even deals with this idea that in Brooklyn, capital is art,
Yeah.
which I
I
love
mean,
that
that's
idea.
the wishful thinking, right?
Right?
Where,
Yeah.
in fact, I actually bring that up in the new Red Hook thing, where they're making fun of each other. The Red Hook is making fun of his girlfriend, who's drawing something, and they talk about how, like, sometimes a napkin drawing, depending on who you are, can buy you a mansion or a cup of coffee, right? Depending on your value. And then he hands her a cup of coffee for the artwork.
Of
It's like,
course. Yeah,
fuck off.
yeah,
Like, come
right.
on,
Yeah,
like,
man.
but he's making fun of her, like,
Sure.
so anyway, but yeah, no, I mean, the idea of yeah, bartering food and services for art
Yeah.
is something I have done, thankfully, when I've gone to a dentist and had a root canal and couldn't pay for it, and he knew I drew comics, and so I did a drawing of him, a comic book
Oh,
character
that's
drawing of
fantastic.
him in
Yeah.
trade for, and I've done it for my cats. I've had operations, and luckily, the veterinarian wanted some drawings of her daughter and
Hey, that's
her
great.
dog, kind of thing. So I've done it, and it really is, it's a bartering. And in fact, going back to the Kickstarter, at the end of the day, I'm only asking for like a few slices of pizza and a cup of coffee,
Oh,
from
yeah.
you, so you can get something cool that, and then the other thing I'm trying to do is to not show a lot of it online. Because I want to create that FOMO of you having to get it in print, number one.
Sure.
Number two, I don't want to keep feeding the machine.
Yeah,
That's going to
exactly.
steal my old work and then take away my new work with my old work. Think of it like that. And I'm about to publish that idea next in my next Substack. It's like, it's stealing my old work and taking away my new work. What
Yeah.
the hell is
Yeah,
that?
why be on that treadmill? No, it's those guys, I don't know if you're familiar with the podcast Comic Lab, Brad Geiger and Dave Kellett. They
Oh yeah, I
talk
think I've
about
heard them.
Yeah, they
Yeah.
talk about comic business all the time, and they've been web comics artists for a long, long time. And the thing they always promote is why do work, for that machine? Why feed that machine? Why not do it for yourself? Build your own business, be independent. And I think that, in the world we live in now, it makes perfect sense, especially the way things are going. But corporations, we know, are heartless, and they take talent, they use it up, and then they spit it out without any
Right.
And we saw that with what happened to all the great masters that we all revere, you know, like Kirby and Steve Ditko, and all the way all those guys were treated. Wally Wood, their lives were they were used up without any consideration for the human cost.
I know. I know. And I'm not even going to get into the Stanley Kirby debate because honestly, like he too was used and everybody saw what the contracts were. And like nobody knew at the time that these things would blow up and become what they are today.
Sure.
And they, you know, all that stuff. And there's a whole bunch of nuances. And yes, Stanley basically took a lot of credit that, you know, maybe he didn't, but he did
Oh yeah.
write dialogue, great comics, and he was a bullhorn for the
Sure.
medium, you know?
Sure.
So
Sure. I mean,
there
you know,
are
the,
theatrics as
yeah,
well.
I have my own feelings about where the weight of the creativity lies, but nevertheless, however you come down, they both contributed an enormous amount to the history of comics and to Marvel Comics and to the characters that, you know, those comics that we love. There's no doubt Fantastic Four was never quite the same without either one of them. And, you know, it's not the comic that I loved. The comic I loved is those 100 issues, 101 issues by, you know, with Jack and Stan.
102. 102.
102, is it 102?
And then there was an issue of three or four, 108. They took an abandoned
Oh,
story
yeah, right. I remember
and kind
that.
of shoved it and put it together and made something with Janice. The character's name was Janice. He was a
Yeah.
two-faced kind of Gemini guy, you
I
know,
kind of
whatever.
remember that. It's a long story, but so the question I have that arises from that is, how long have you been in this business now as a freelancer? I mean, you've been a freelancer your whole adult life, have you not?
Well, so I think around age 30-ish is when I could say I'm 56 going on 57 in May, right?
Right.
So I would say when I did Night Falls on Yancey Street from Marvel is when I quit my part-time job. I always had a part-time job. I was a waiter, you know, I worked as a graphics monkey for a corporation, and it was all very like I just never took a real job or a 9-to-5 job because my eye was on the prize, right? To
Sure.
make comics. So I would say that when I finally quit a job that was like the monthly paycheck, which is terrifying, but I knew that I had at least a year's worth of work ahead of me, right? Was around 2000, 2001 or something like that, maybe. So I'd say a good 25 years, you know,
That's
I've been
amazing.
not sleeping for 25 years.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's gotta be really unnerving,
It's
particularly
gotten
in this
worse. It's
business.
gotten horrifying. It is terrifying, which is another reason why Kickstarter, but I can't live on Kickstarter alone. Like I do get a little gig here and there. I just did a couple of covers for this person and that. And like, you know, but I'm begging for morsels these days. But I used to hit harder the editors at Marvel and DC, and I'm not these days. And I just think like I'm gonna beg for a few morsels. And I've done a Conan story. I did a Conan the Barbarian story a year and a half ago. Will it come out? I don't know. You know, but you do, and then I did a 20-page horror story for another anthology, and I've done three covers for that. But you know, you want it to come out because it continues to recommend you, hopefully,
Sure.
right?
Yeah.
But when it's not out there and it's invisible because it's waiting for a scheduling thing or whatever, I'm just like, it looks like I've disappeared. And
Yeah.
I haven't. I've done. I write plays. I make comics. I do all kinds of stuff. I help these people out. I'm involved in that. But like, you got to constantly be showing up in order to prove that you exist, you
Yeah.
know, in this social media world we live in right now, you know. And I keep wondering if maybe disappearing is the new way of showing up.
Yeah,
I don't know.
it's an interesting point of view. But it's true, it's like a treadmill. And you do think finding the way to survive as a freelancer, finding a way to survive in this in the comics world, but in the media world in general, right, is you're competing against so much. So I have to say, I have the greatest admiration for your stick-to-itiveness, your chutzpah, your skill at
Thank you.
navigating all this, man. Because I know I've been very fortunate in my life to have this job that I have here, and I was in the right place at the right time. Very lucky in that regard. And every day I thank my lucky stars that I've got this job. And it's just I don't know how it, I don't. I'm thinking about retiring now in a couple of years, and it scares the crap out of me because I'm like, oh my gosh,
Well, you mean for money retiring,
Yeah,
but you'll
yeah.
never retire because you're an
Oh
artist.
no,
So
because I'm an artist.
you're
You don't retire for no. That'll be
No.
like a godsend. It'll be like, oh my gosh, I can spend all my time doing my work now.
Right.
Fantastic. But and I'll keep doing Kickstarters and stuff, and hopefully building that up. But yeah, all of the insecurities that come with being freelancer. It's a hard life. But you made it work and continue to make it work.
Well, on the skin of my teeth, but. And I appreciate people like you who are like, Dean, let's talk about it on your show. And
Yeah.
hopefully your listeners will pick up what I'm laying down or what we're laying down. And that's part of the machine. That's part of the perpetuating like this kind of autonomous lane, carving this lane, of
Yeah.
autonomy, right?
Yeah.
So, and then luckily you have a job, and like when you decide to leave it, right now, I think there's another paradigm shift happening. Hopefully we'll figure out what's happening. I'm a little bit a part of it, I guess. I'm not a revolutionary, but I guess I'm part of something or whatever. But it'll give it a little bit of time because being an entrepreneur is more than ever right now, I think,
Oh
you know.
yeah.
And people who can actually make something that's interesting and deliver it is a
Yeah.
whole other thing,
Oh
like
yeah. Seeing it
so.
through and bring it to fruition and
That's
get it
right.
to people. Yeah. Absolutely. Dean, I have so many questions to ask you. And I mean, really, so many, and we could spend like 14 hours talking about,
Yes,
your experience. I mean, because I want to know about, how you met Howie Chaykin and Walt
right.
Simonson, because I revere those guys. I
Oh,
absolutely,
me too.
I
Well,
grew up.
why don't we put a button on this, and then honestly, I'm down. I love talking to you. It's so easy. Why don't we do another one soon? And actually, yeah, don't tell me the questions because I love to wing it, answer wing
Yeah.
it.
No, absolutely. Let's do that.
But definitely, let's have another conversation. Right now, this will be like the one we had that kind of helps promote the Red Hook Kickstarter, and
Sure.
then we'll get to another conversation because we're talking creativity right now,
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's great. I'm really enjoying it. And again, I have so many questions because I was holding up this book before Cuba. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about Howard
Absolutely.
Pekar and Simonson and Chaykin and all those great guys. And this has just been so great. But
Oh, thank you.
yeah,
Thank you.
it really is. And finally, to connect with you is so great because I've been a fan. And I also want to say, folks who are listening, go to
Right.
Kickstarter, look up Dean Haspiel. I'm going to put a link in the show notes so that you can go there immediately, following the listening to this, and put your two cents in, pick out your rewards because they're great. And I can't recommend COVID Cop, Billy Dogman, Chain Legit, and now The Red Hook times Dean Haspiel. Can't
Thank
recommend
you so
enough.
much.
Yeah,
Thank you.
absolutely, man. It's so exciting. And so okay, we'll say farewell for now, and we'll maybe we could hook up in a week or two, maybe towards the end of Kickstarter, and follow up. Yeah, all right.
Absolutely.
All
Absolutely.
right. Sounds
Thank
great.
you. Thanks, Jeffrey.
So there you have it, Dean Haspiel part one, and I'm looking forward to part two in the next few weeks. In the meantime, you know what to do. If you haven't done it already, shame on you. Head over to Kickstarter right now, follow the link in the show notes, and check out The Red Hook times Dean Haspiel. You will not be disappointed. It's bound to be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to it. And well, I'm sure you will be too. If you love comics, you gotta love Dean Haspiel stuff, and you gotta love The Red Hook. So check it out, okay? Kickstarter, Dean Haspiel's The Red Hook times Dean Haspiel. We will have another show upcoming in the next couple of weeks. I'm not sure exactly which guest is coming on first, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be Gene Cannenberg. And Gene Cannenberg has a brand new Peanuts pop-up book coming out from Abrams, and I'm really looking forward to it. And, as a matter of fact, I can't wait to get my hands on this. And Gene, of course, is not only a comic scholar and a cartoonist and a librarian, but he's also a bookmaker. And I don't mean like he takes bets. No, I mean actually he makes physical books. A librarian who makes his own books. Who knew? And so this has got to be a lot of fun, this book. I can't wait to see it.
So Gene Kannenberg is going to be on in the next couple of weeks. And if you've never heard of him, well, you're going to love this. You're going to love it because Gene is a big lover of comics, a lover of Peanuts, and a really just terrific all-around guy. It's always nice to kind of circle back to this show's inspiration, Charles Schulz and Peanuts. As you know by now, I'm a huge fan, and it's always nice to get back to the world of Charles Schulz and do tribute to him in whatever way possible. And this is a wonderful idea. I'm amazed that it's not been done in the past. So kudos to Gene for that original thought. I'd like to take a moment and thank two longtime contributors to the Patreon for this show at patreon.com/Jeff Grogan. First of all, I want to thank Ray Rapizzi. Ray Rapizzi has been a contributor to this show since the very beginning, and it's meant so much to me to have his support over the course of the length of this podcast. And so thank you, Ray, for all your support over the years. It has meant a great deal to me. You can find Ray, who does some wonderful cartoons, on Instagram at It's a Ray Ray Day. Secondly, I want to take a second to thank longtime friend of the show and former guest, Khalid Birdsong, for his support as well. Khalid, as you know, if you've listened to the show for a long time, is a great cartoonist, and he's just a wonderful guy, and he's got a great Substack right now. It's khalidbirdsong.substack.com, called A New Creative Life, which I've enjoyed right from the beginning, and it's filled with all kinds of things. Khalid's wonderful cartooning, some great caricatures, some insights into philosophy and life and creativity. It's just terrific, and I like to start pretty much every day that it comes in the mailbox with Khalid's Substack. So look for that, okay? khalidbirdsong.substack.com, and you can find him on Instagram at Khalid Birdsong. That's KHALIDBIRDSONG. Okay? Thanks again, fellas. While I'm on the subject of the Patreon, which can be found at patreon.com/Jeff Grogan, GEOFFGROGAN, consider joining us at any one of the tiers that are available or at an amount you choose. I admit I've been remiss over the past few years in paying attention to the Patreon, just as the show ran into some issues last year with some personal problems that I've spoken about before. The Patreon sort of went by the same way, but I'm renewing my focus on the show. I've got some great guests lined up for the future. I hope to keep it going for as long as possible. It is a labor of love, after all, but your support is greatly appreciated because the show obviously is not without expense. So any amount you can contribute is greatly appreciated. And as I said, there's a variety of stuff there you can check into, and I'd love to have you join us there. So give it a thought. Head on over to patreon.com/Jeff Grogan, GEOFFGROGAN, and give it a look-see. I want to keep this show going ad-free, subscription-free, for as long as conceivable in the next few years. So help us keep the motor running here at Blockhead. Check out the Patreon, again, at patreon.com/Jeff Grogan. And thanks a lot. So we'll be back in about 10 to 12 days. In the meantime, you can always find me on Instagram at Green Screen Comic, that's one word, or at Grogan Jeff. That's where you'll find me posting most of the time. And if you want to keep up with my work or want to get any of my comics or anything, you can check it out on my Etsy shop. That's etsy.com/shop/comicsprintworks, where I have a number of things available. So and sometime in May, I think, I will have copies of my very limited edition recent Kickstarter project, Donut and the Cheeseburger, Race for the White House 2024. And that's going to be kind of fun. It's back to newspaper. It's a tabloid newspaper featuring like 20 pages of full-color comics by me, most of which deal with exactly that, the race for the White House. And then there's a couple of other pages of a side strip I did called Announcing Bob, which which I'm actually was quite happy with and had a lot of fun with, and so that's there too. And that'll be sometime in May. And anyone who joins at a paid level now on patreon.com/Jeff Grogan between March 11th and sometime in May when it comes out will receive a complimentary copy of my tabloid newspaper Kickstarter project, limited edition Donut and the Cheeseburger, Race to the White House, signed by me. So sign up now at a paid level, no matter which level it is, you will get a complimentary copy of Donut and the Cheeseburger sent right to your mailbox. So, and that is going to be worth who knows how much someday because it's a limited edition. So secure your kids' future. Don't delay. Join today for Donut and the Cheeseburger, okay? I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I hope you'll be back for more. Hope you're well and happy and safe and all is good in your life these days. And in the meantime, as always, thanks for listening.